Please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking about politics in the workplace. Anne-Marie Story, employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell, will be talking about how employers can be affected by this important topic. She's also going to be providing an update on a couple cases having to do with the FMLA. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we're talking with Anne-Marie Story. She is an employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell Law Firm in Bangor, Maine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm so glad to have you back.
Appreciate being here.
You know, you have been doing great work all across the state with a lot of great clients. How's business been up in the Bangor area?
It's been excellent, very busy.
Yes, I bet it has. And, you know, in terms of this area, employment law really continues to be ever-changing, isn't it? I mean, there's just, though it's been a relatively quiet year, has it not?
It has not been a quiet year. It never is in employment law. And every time you think you've seen everything, something changes your mind.
There's no question about it. Well, we're going to be talking about today a topic that people get very passionate about. It's called politics in the workforce. You know, one of the things that I think about is, you know, candidates, people come in, they have an opinion, owners have an opinion. Everybody has an opinion, right, when they're talking about politics. And sometimes they want to share that opinion in the workplace. Tell me some general overview of how employers should really look at this and how they should handle it.
Okay, well, I think you can break this into several categories depending on the way in which the issue comes up. So there might be a situation where an employer feels strongly about a candidate or an issue and tries to push that
agenda
view on its employees.
Sure.
So that's one issue. More likely, you'll have employees who have their own views about things and engage in dispute or argument, and that could take place in the workplace. Or, you know, we're seeing this happening on social media outside of the workplace, but of course the ramifications come into the workplace when they're no longer getting along or they disagree so strenuously about something.
So let's break this down a little bit, as you said. Let's talk about, first, if somebody is talking about politics and it disrupts the workforce, they come in and people are like, a Trump sticker on a Trump button on their coat or something, or they saw a Hillary button. I'm going to play both sides of politics so that I don't have anybody on the show going, hey, what is he supporting? See, even we're politically correct here on the station. This is how it works on the HR Power Hour. So tell me about what company employers can do if it disrupts the workplace.
I think the best advice for employers is to just step back and treat it as they would any other performance or disciplinary related issue. And so I think as opposed to concentrating on the basis of the argument, they just want to deal with the behavior. And so if somebody has one button on and somebody doesn't like it, or somebody saw a bumper sticker in the parking lot that they disagree with, that's fine. They can have their conversations during break time or any other time on their own. But if they engage in behavior that disrupts the workplace, the employer should be able to apply its regular performance-related disciplinary policy.
How about when it comes to, like, issues, not just the candidate, but issues, and people are looking to raise awareness about the minimum wage or about medical or about marijuana use, which is going to be on the ballot here in 2016. These are issues in which people start try to, you know, get support in the workplace, talk quietly amongst one another and try to garner support. How can employers do anything about that?
Well, this is an area where I think employers have to be very careful because, as I'm sure you know and most employers out there know, there's been an awful lot of activity from the NLRB in the last couple of years about workplace behavior Even non-unionized workplaces are subject to Section 7, and employees have rights to engage in certain conversations, concerted activity. And so anything like that, that an employer has to be very careful about inappropriately inhibiting discussions that could be related to concerted activity or the rights of employees. And so, again, I think you want to take it back to performance-based actions. And so if it's merely a matter of people engaging in conversation during break time, let it go. Even if they're having an argument, or as long as it's not disruptive to the workplace, I think an employer has to be very careful about trying to control the topic or the subject matter.
What if the employer has a non-solicitation policy?
Well, they can have a non-solicitation policy, and I think that's important to think through ahead of time. I think the key to that, though, is to apply it consistently. And so you can't say an employee can't talk about forming a union or, some political issue, but at the same time say it's perfectly okay to talk about the Girl Scouts or raising money for your charity. You just have to be consistent.
It does. There is a fine line, isn't there? Because people are more than happy to talk about their kids' events, and if there's a fundraiser for chocolates for the popcorn for the Boy Scouts or cookies for the Girl Scouts. But it kind of has to be everything covered. Can you have a policy that differentiates the two? Can it state that certain things are okay? I know I'm parsing lines a little bit, but can the company say, hey, it's okay to have children's events or supports? Can they be that definitive?
I have seen employers try to walk that line, and I think it's a very difficult, if not impossible, line to walk because, again, you cannot inhibit union-related conduct. And so you couldn't have a policy, for instance, that said, we're happy to have you solicit on behalf of the Girl Scouts or the Boy Scouts, but don't even think about coming in here and talking about raising money for a union-based activity or a religious activity or anything. I think it's too difficult to find where that line is and too easy to run afoul of it. So I think employers have to decide either we're going to let people solicit in the workplace or we're not.
So from a equipment standpoint, somebody prints out something that has an ad on it from a political ad, or they decide to post it up in the office or at their desk. Hey, it's my own private desk. I can put up my little, supporting XYZ candidate. Tell me about your thoughts about that.
Well, again, I think the same thing is true. And it's interesting that you use the phrase, hey, it's my own private desk, because I do think there might be some perception from employees that that's the case, but in fact it's not, because it's the employer's property. And so an employer can always control what's in even somebody's quote-unquote personal workspace. So I think it goes back again to the same bottom line rule. Either we're not posting anything or we're going to allow, reasonable postings, and that would include encouragement of unions or whatever it is, or, I support the Girl Scouts.
So I'm just going to back up for a second, because we've been talking about private employers. What about public employers?
There are some additional prohibitions on what's appropriate in a public workplace as opposed to a private workplace. I think the difference is that individuals who work in a public workplace have certain rights that an individual in a private workplace does not have. So a private employer has more ability to say, we're not doing this and we're not doing that, whereas a public employee might have a little bit more of a right to expression.
Okay. One of the things that has been the big area that has been a lot of rulemaking lately is social media. Well, social media also is a big place for political thoughts and sharing your political views. Actually, to be honest with you, sharing way too much. Let's just talk about that. Way too much about everything. But from a political standpoint, people go on their social media at work. They go on and on their cell phones, whatever their personal devices are. People see it sometimes. Tell me about how employers have to think about that in this 2016 races.
Well, this is a huge issue, not just, as you mentioned, for politics and the upcoming election, but for all subject matter, because employers are facing more and more employees who are having disputes over social media, and that comes into the workplace, or employees are using social media to be critical of their employer for various reasons. And of course, employers are inclined to say, you can't do that, I'm going to shut it down. But there's very little an employer can do about an employee's private social media account. And it seems like there's a lot of situations now where I'm counseling employers about employees who are unable to get along, and they're letting that out through social media, saying nasty things about each other. And then, of course, they come into the workplace, and that impacts their ability to do their job. Again, the employer, in my view, should concentrate on the behavior and the performance in the workplace, but not try to control what somebody's doing on their personal social media. Now, that would be very different in the event that the social media were the employer. So if it's my own, like it's our law firm's website, and we allow, you know, blogs or other forms of posting on there, then we have more control over what somebody would say because it's our social media. But for personal social media, you know, my view is, number one, an employer should just stay off it completely. Employers should not be friending employees. Supervisors should not be friends with employees because that just inevitably leads to trouble. And better off just to stay out of it completely.
So let's talk about that for just a little bit more. If you're an employer and you support certain causes or certain candidates, there are obviously many employers that have a belief in certain things, and they may use that platform, their social media platform for their company, to actually say those views and put them out there. What type of risk do they have on that?
For an employer
to
promote its own views? Yep. Well, an employer is entitled to its views just like anybody else. I think the employer should make it clear, though, that it's the viewpoint of the entity as opposed to its individual employees. And, you know, really think through whether they want to do that as part of the business or whether they would prefer to do it as an individual. Because, of course, once you start to do that as a platform for the business, assuming that you have employees who are going to feel differently, and you can almost be sure that you will, you're really just stepping right into that problem. And you may end up with employees who then go on their own social media and criticize the employer for its views. And then, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to respond negatively to that.
So sometimes candidates visit employers. They come in and they, you know, either the senator or somebody arrives, candidate arrives. And an employee might say, well, I don't particularly want to be here for that day, but they're a critical piece of the work. What does an employer have to think about in that aspect?
Well, there's no, you know, protected category for political views, and so I wouldn't say that there's any established right for an employee not to be there. But if an employee chooses to not be present when somebody comes into the workplace, I suppose they could request their own personal time off, and an employer should consider granting that, or at least, you know, having the candidate come maybe during lunchtime when somebody can be out and be somewhere else. I certainly would never suggest that an employer coerce or force employees to attend meetings with candidates or to be involved in any way if they choose not to.
We're talking with Anne-Marie Story from the law firm of Rudman and Winchell up in Bangor, Maine. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Anne-Marie Story. She's an employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell, and we're talking about the great topic of politics in the workplace. I won't put you on the spot of who you're voting for. We're just going to move on. How's that?
That's a good thing.
All right. Well, you know, we talked a little bit about in the last segment about some of the things that employers and employees need to be thinking about when they're at work. And we talked a little about social media. One of the things that I know is there's a law change that happened in Maine at the end of last year, 215, that affects employees and employers. Tell us a little bit about it so that even if people are aware, they're more aware because it does apply in this case.
It does. And really what it does is solidify what most of the employment lawyers like me have been telling employers all along. And that is but now it's actually law as opposed to just good advice. You cannot, as an employer, require that an employee disclose his or her own personal social media account information. You can't require them to let you access it. You can't coerce them somehow into having access to it. And so sometimes you hear stories about employers who want to see a private social media account and they have somebody else friend that person. And I don't know how a lot of this works, so I'm grasping at the friend who's friending who and how that works. But you can't have somebody else try to access that information and then use that to see it yourself. So in other words, employers just have to stand back completely from an employee's private social media account and not be involved in it at all.
So the one question that always comes up about this is, what if it has to do with harassment claim? What if somebody is harassing over social media or something has been said on social media that has created a issue at the workplace? And so obviously the law covers that, I'm assuming.
It does. And there's a specific prohibition in the law. And so in a situation where the employer reasonably believes there's information on that personal social media account that relates to an investigation of employee misconduct or a claim by an employee about something that happened in the workplace, then the employer is within its rights to request disclosure of that information. Presumably, if the employee then refuses, an employer could try to get a subpoena for the information. So the actual law change itself, while it still prohibits an employer from getting it directly, there are certain circumstances under which an employer will be able to access it. And that also includes, of course, any social media maintained by the employer. So in other words, an employee can't password protect information that's being accessed through the employer's machinery or computers or anything else. So if it's employer-provided equipment, the employer is still going to be able to access whatever an employee does there.
I think that's where the blending happens, right? You have a personal cell phone, which an employer then gives you access to have the email on the personal cell phone, not the company phone now. It's my personal cell phone. And yet I have access to company email, company accounts on that phone. So there's a blend, right, between if it's the company phone, which used to be pretty simple, company phone, personal phone. Talk a little bit about that blending problem that and what the recommendation really has been lately. It was for a while that companies gave out phones. And then they said, well, why are we giving out phone? Because people have two phones. They have their own personal and they have this phone. So now they went to, we'll give you a stipend for doing and having this on your phone and using it. Now there's almost this, like, well, maybe we should be giving phones back again. What's your thought on that?
There are a lot of very dangerous issues with having an employee use a personal cell phone for work purposes. And you've got, so that raises immediate issues in terms of access, which is what we've been talking about, because an employer should be able to access whatever an employee does related to the workplace. But, of course, it's the personal cell phone, and they would not be entitled to any of the employee's personal information on the phone. Second of all, that raises wage and hour issues, just like with an employer-provided phone, but at least there's more control over what's going on with an employer-provided phone. If an employee has his or her own personal cell phone, but then ends up doing work from that phone, and the employer knows about it, then you've got to be paying, make sure that you're compensating them appropriately, and that could turn into a very bad situation down the line if you're not doing that.
This new law, what does it not prohibit? Because I know it really does prohibit a lot of information from being shared with the employer. Are there certain ways that employers can, other than obviously for harassment or different investigation, is there anything else where that they could actually, employers can actually monitor their cell phones or monitor social media if, in fact, it's, for example, company accounts?
Well, this specific law refers, in terms of the exclusions from the new law, specifically refers to accessing personal social media account information, not from the employer's account, that is related to an investigation of allegations of employee misconduct or a work-related violation of any applicable rules or laws. So if that were to be the case, then the employer would have a case for accessing even information on a personal cell phone, I think. But again, the process of getting that is not clear from the law. All it says is it doesn't prohibit you from having it. Then we have to think through, well, what's the appropriate way to get it? If it's the employer-provided equipment, it would be a lot easier to access because you could simply take the phone and access it. Assuming, of course, you'd want to have a policy ahead of time saying that for employer-provided equipment, we can access it any time with or without notice, those kinds of provisions. But it's if it's an employee-provided phone that they are encouraged to or directed to use for business-related purposes, you can see the difficulty. You can't just confiscate the phone, probably, and then you're going to have to maybe follow a different procedure with more hoops to go through to get that.
IT monitors a lot of, if you want to call it, company property. Sometimes they even help with personal property for small businesses. Family businesses, let's be honest, they don't necessarily have all the equipment. They just have somebody use their phone, and IT helps with that. Is there any policies that should be in place in terms of what IT can monitor and not monitor in terms of, you know, somebody's iPad or somebody's even cell phone? But more, I'm thinking more on the equipment side.
Well, I think generally the rule for employers to follow is that they should have a policy, first of all, if they think that they may want to monitor any employer-provided equipment or business-related things happening on personal equipment, so that an employee knows that anything they say or write or type or communicate for business-related purposes is subject to review and they do not have a right of privacy in it. But when you're accessing a private telephone or other computer or other similar devices, the general rule is that the employer can look only enough to find out whether something is business-related or not. And if it's personal, they must immediately disregard it and not review it. And you can see, of course, how that can turn into multiple disputes because where's the line? How much do I review before I determine it's personal as opposed to business? And what if it's an email from somebody to a friend that talks about the business? It's not business related, but it's critical of the employer, and now you've seen it. And so, again, that's a very good reason why to separate out employer-provided equipment from personal.
Well, when we're talking about politics, this is all about what has been happening on the national side in regards to Hillary and the emails. I mean, there's a great example of employer, right? I mean, there's a great example of a private server account and everything else that goes with it. Irregardless of what the opinion of what has happened, that's a great example of private and personal being mixed.
That's exactly right. And the other area where employers need to be particularly careful, I think, is in the for folks who telecommute. So if you've got somebody working from home, and that seems to be an increased trend again for economic-related reasons, you need to think through ahead of time whose equipment is it in the home place. Because if it's an employee's home computer and they're doing work through it, you can imagine what else might be on there. You've got kids using it. You've got, you know, household accounts. You've got who knows what on that computer intermingled with your business-related stuff. And so my very firm view is that if you have people who telecommute, you need to set up a separate workspace with your equipment that's devoted solely to the work that they're doing.
All right, getting back and talking a little bit about politics in terms of if an employer wishes to ban political everything. So in other words, I don't want bumper stickers on any of the cars in my lot. It's my private lot. I don't want to have everything to do with it. I don't want to have political button stickers on my employees. I don't want to have on my screen that comes up on the desktop, right, which would be the home screen, having any political stuff on that. What do employers, what can they do? What can't they do? And you're smiling. So I know it happens. Come on, this stuff happens. What's your thoughts on all that?
My thoughts are that I think an employer needs to moderate that view. First of all, you can't and shouldn't try to control things like what kind of bumper sticker somebody has on your vehicle. In fact, there are other things that you can't control in your parking lot as well, such as now the concealed weapons issue. So I think, you know, employers need to get away from the notion that they control everything within their environment, because the reality is that they don't and shouldn't try to. In terms of controlling what's in the workplace, again, they've got to find a moderate position, because, you know, this is like the policies that people used to talk about, banning all use of cell phones or anything else for any personal reason whatsoever. It's not feasible and it's not going to happen. And what will happen is that it's going to be applied consistently, and then you're going to end up with a potential claim from somebody who thinks it was because of a protected category. And exactly the same thing, I think, would happen if you said, I'm banning all information, all anything having to do with politics or personal views or anything else.
So even at in the office itself or in the employment itself?
Well, I think it's a matter of moderation and to some extent employee morale as well, because the minute you try to say, you know, I don't want to see any personalized information on anybody in anybody's workstation, where's the line to that? So why is it okay to display a picture of your kid who might have not that I'm picking on the Girl Scouts, but who might have a child who might have a Girl Scout outfit on, and somebody has an issue with whatever the Girl Scouts do, but it's not okay to put up a little sign saying I support Hillary. And so this is just the two words to concentrate on are moderation and treating people consistently. And factor in, for instance, the National Labor Relations Act gives employees the right to display labor union insignia. So if those are somehow connected to a message of politics, then how do you separate that out?
Well, you talk about wearing stuff. So dress code for a lot of companies that deal with the public, for example, is rather important, right? So that they'd be wearing some sort of outfit representing the company. What if an employer doesn't want them to put on that uniform, a pin or a badge or something that talks about politics in terms of what they support? Is that reasonable?
I think, again, as long as you treat the issue of politics consistently with everything else, it would be reasonable to do that. And I think that's understandable, that you're presenting the image of the employer, but at the same time, you can't allow certain things that an employer might like, but not allow things that they don't like.
Well, I think about, you know, somebody delivers the gas to your house and they're in a uniform, right? And they're putting up there and they should be wearing their own uniform hat, but they're wearing a political hat or I support marijuana, legalization of marijuana, right? Because I think, and when I look at 216, that issue is going to be one of those really hot issues that are going to be talked about. And we're going to be talking about it on this show, as a matter of fact. We're going to have people on to have that debate and discussion about legalizing not only for medical marijuana, which we've talked about for years, but now for recreational. And I'm sure we're going to have a whole show on what that really can do, thinking about Colorado and the other states that have done it. But I just want to make sure the employer still feels like they have some control over how they want a image presented to their clientele.
Yes, I absolutely think employers still have the ability to control almost entirely the image that's presented to the public and the community. Again, it comes back, though, to consistency. So an employer should not say you can't wear a hat that talks about medical marijuana when you're wearing our uniform, but you can wear a hat saying I support the Boy Scouts.
It makes perfect sense to me. We're talking with Anne-Marie Story. She is an employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell Law Firm. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB and presented by cmacareer.com. Today, we've been talking with Anne-Marie Story. She is the employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell, and we've been talking about politics in the workplace. All right, so, you know, in the last segment, we talked a little bit about dress code and what employers can really control in terms of an image when we left. One of the things that comes up is employees overhear or talk around the water cooler, or today probably talk around, you know, a lunchroom, about what views candidates have. And they get kind of upset when a candidate says something about a race or says something about illegal immigration or says something about something that they passionately disagree with. And I know that there have been situations where one employee goes to the supervisor and says, I can't work with that person anymore because I think that their opinions are too extreme and they're a racist and they're, you know, this is how I feel about them and I don't want to work with them anymore. What can an employer do?
Well, my short answer is it's too bad for the employee. I mean, this goes back to you're here to do a job. Whether somebody disagrees with your personal views or not is entirely irrelevant unless and until it comes into the workplace in a performance-related manner. So if I am the employee with the view that the other person doesn't like, and I know that, and I purposefully rankle that person or try to create an argument or a fight because of it, that would be a performance-related issue. But if somebody just simply doesn't want to associate with me because I happen to support a candidate and have stated that I support a candidate who has certain views, it's not a workplace issue, in my view. I mean, it may become one, and that's what we're seeing, is because people are expressing more and more of this on social media, then it does come back into the workplace because then you've got people who won't get along or can't get along or, you know, try to bring in sides and, you know, pick fights and whatnot. But again, I think the best course for an employer is to ignore out-of-work activity unless and until it becomes a performance-related issue.
So let's talk about that out-of-work activity, the off-duty situation, where I decide to march and support a cause that is completely against what the employer believes or what my employees might believe. And I think that that is, well, let's use the marijuana issue, because I think that that's going to be the big one in 216. So I support legalization of marijuana, and I work for a healthcare industry that is completely not supporting it and actually donating money to the cause. I work for a large hospital. I'm in a position of authority. I'm one of the leadership there. What can an employer do? Because, hey, there's an image now of I am a leader of the community in that particular hospital, but I support a absolute cause that is not necessarily supported by my industry or my hospital.
Well, you know, that's a difficult consideration because, you know, what I would like to say is what's true is that the employee has an absolute right to believe in whatever they want to believe in. And there's very little ability by an employer to control somebody's off-duty conduct. So as long as I'm not doing something in the workplace that works to the detriment of my employer or its business, it would be very hard to discipline or terminate or take other action against that individual because they're out on the weekends saying what it is they believe in. it may be that the employer and the employee come to a point where there's a philosophical difference of opinion that can't be rectified, and they may choose to part course at that point. But it would be dangerous for an employer to take disciplinary or termination steps against an employee as long as the conduct is occurring completely outside of the workplace and within the bounds of the employee's own opinion. It might be different if the employee made representations that they were speaking on behalf of the employer. And I think that would be different, and that would be something the employer could control.
Let's take it up one more notch. An employee works for some sort of organization. They're supporting against legalization of in this particular case, let's say marijuana. And they're on the front page of the paper at an event that's actually outside smoking it. It's not legal yet, but they're part of the group protesting that this should be legalized. And we've seen these pop up around the area where people are actually, you know, they have these little pot groups that they're actually out there. So what's the thought on that in terms of employees? I'm giving you some good stuff.
Well,
today.
My first thought is that I'm moving in the wrong circle because I'm not aware of these smoking groups. But my second thought, so is the employee actually engaging in the unlawful behavior?
Yes, and maybe it was on social media. Maybe it's not even on. We'll say the paper be one thing flashed on the front page. They just happen to be part of the group. But the other would be someone sees that they're smoking marijuana on Facebook. An employer sees. I think that may even be more relevant and quick to see. The paper example is a big example, but just think about if somebody's doing illegal drugs on Facebook.
Well, I think there's certainly a line that has been crossed now between what an employee is entitled to engage in terms of off-conduct behavior versus engaging in illegal conduct that's now public. And so I think an employer, assuming, well, we don't know if criminal action is going to be taken against the employee by the relevant authority.
Probably would not be based upon.
Even if it's not, I think an employer could probably take steps based on the employee's illegal conduct. Although, I mean, you know, as you think that through, you have to be careful to be sure that the conduct was actually unlawful, that the employee actually engaged in it. But, you know, again, employers, assuming that the employee is at will, has the ability to take action against an employee for any reason or no reason, as long as it's not an unlawful reason. So if the image is that the employee is engaging in illegal behavior publicly, as long as that was not protected conduct because they were an authorized medical marijuana user, then I think an employer could take action against them.
I know that the line's always drawn there between the federal and the state, right, in terms of that currently. And so they say, well, it's legal in the state, but it's not really legal federally. There are some employers that are towing the line saying we're only going to focus on the federal side of this. Is that a wise decision, or is that something that you look at in terms of holding employees accountable for, you know, state law versus federal law?
Well, the state law specifically provides that an employer cannot discriminate against somebody who's a lawful user in the state of medical marijuana. So even though it remains illegal from a federal perspective, as long as the employee is an authorized user under the Maine law, I think employers have to respect that and cannot take action against them. If they do, they will violate the Maine law.
This excludes, of course, federal DOT drivers or anything having to do with a federal entity.
That's right. And, of course, there are limitations in the law about what employees can do. So, for instance, it doesn't require an employer to allow an employee to use marijuana at the workplace or to come to work under the influence, which is, you know, entirely undefinable.
Right. No, there's no question that that's part of the challenge of the law, right? It's not completely defined well in terms of that at all.
Well, what employers are struggling with is, you know, it's easy to say you can't use it while you're here or while you're on work time. What's not easy to figure out is how do you know whether somebody's under the influence or not? So if the employee used the medical marijuana the night before, is it still in their system or is it not? I don't know how an employer's, supposed to know that.
Right. It's one of the challenges because there aren't any real good tests.
Nope.
in terms of that today? I know they're working on it, but that's certainly nothing today in terms of that. So as we wrap up the discussion about politics in the workplace, and of course the last segment today, we're going to be talking about the FMLA and an update from you on that. What are the couple of things that you would say to an employer to really think about overall when they're thinking about politics and workforce? What are like the three top things you would say? These are things that you need to be, you know, I would say thick skin, because I think that that's a big thing, right? What are three things that you recommend in terms of either a policy, procedure, or process?
Well, I think number one is be prepared. So if you anticipate that you're going to have issues with this in the workplace and you don't have a policy already about what's okay and what's not okay, put it in place now. The second thing would probably be, as I've said many times, be consistent. Treat all employees the same way, regardless of the topic or the issue. And the third thing, I think, especially with politics coming up, is don't let emotions get the best of a situation. You know, if you've got employees who have firm views that you disagree with, that's something you may just have to live with.
You're listening to Anne Marie Story, and she gives great advice here on the HR Power Hour. And we'll be right back with an update on the FMLA. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Anne Marie Story from Rudman & Winchell, law firm in Bangor, Maine, covering the great state of Maine. Anne Marie, we talked about politics in the workplace last segment, but you're going to now give us a nice update on some of the things happening with the FMLA. What's new?
Well, there have been a couple of interesting decisions. There's nothing new necessarily in terms of the law itself. And of course, these are federal, having to do with the federal FMLA, not the Maine state FMLA, because there are cases from all over the U.S.
And FMLA is?
The Family Medical Leave Act.
Yes.
And of course, there is this, the federal and the state, which differ pretty significantly. So these deal with the federal law, which applies to employers with 50 or more employees. So one of the first cases was just simply a good reminder to employers. It's one of those cases where you kind of say, duh, you know, in terms of applying the FMLA. And it was just a situation where the employee reported that to his employer that he needed leave to take care of his critically ill wife. And the employer was accommodating in the sense that they allowed him to take all of the time that he had available on the books in terms of personal vacation and sick days. However, once he used that time up, he was in a position of being disciplined and ultimately terminated. And it was striking to apparently everybody but this employer that they never even thought to apply the FMLA to him. So there's no question that that's a violation of his FMLA rights, and he was awarded damages. And, you know, again, it's just a very simple reminder not to forget that the FMLA is out there.
Absolutely. What's the second change? And this basically has to do with excuse working mandatory overtime.
Well, this was actually a very significant case, and this was about a situation that employers do see pretty frequently, and that is somebody who was alleging they had cluster headaches. And the employee argued that this was a serious health condition under the Family Medical Leave Act. And, of course, it's one of those situations where he needed time off that seemed a little bit questionable. And so in this case, in particular, mandatory overtime was part of his mandatory job responsibilities. He was a union employee, and it was in the contract. There was no dispute that he was required to work overtime when requested by the employer. And what he alleged was that he had these headaches, and they only came on after he worked his regular hours, but before he started his overtime. So in other words, the extra overtime hours are what caused or contributed to his formation of these headaches. And so what he asked for was FMLA time to essentially excuse him from working any of the overtime hours. And that became an issue from the employer's perspective, as you might imagine, because what it does is it changes the entire nature of the job. It moves it from a job where there's mandatory overtime required to somebody who's now working a regular 40-hour shift, but all of his colleagues are continuing to have to work the mandatory overtime. And so the employer balked at providing the intermittent FMLA to cover those periods when he said he couldn't work. And one of the really interesting issues in this case is that it wasn't often a matter of his needing the time because he actually was having the headache. It was a matter of his requesting the hours not to be worked so that he didn't develop the headache. So in other words, he didn't even have the serious health condition at the time he was asking for the leave. And the employer, responded by saying, but the FMLA is intended to cover a serious health condition that's actually occurring at the time, as opposed to, you know, let's take steps to make sure something doesn't happen. Well, the court in that situation actually sided with the employee and said that the law is broad enough to encompass a situation where somebody can use FMLA time so as to prohibit the development of a condition. And it permitted him to use intermittent FMLA time so that he did not have to work the overtime hours, which he alleged, with his doctor's support, would lead to development of these cluster headaches. And actually, the court pointed to the regulations, which I think a lot of people are sort of unaware that there's all these nuggets in the regulations that exist that you don't see.
Nobody looks at, of course.
Right, until they come up. And this is one of those situations. And the court noted that the regulations refer, as an example, to an employee with asthma who's unable to report to work at any particular time because his doctor said, stay home when the pollen levels are high. And that condition would be covered by the federal FMLA. Well, you can imagine what the ramifications of that might be. And so we've not seen a lot of application of this. And this case didn't get a whole lot of press, but I think it's a very significant decision.
While it didn't get a lot of press, that certainly could be a precedent-setting type situation.
Well, you know, if you think already about potential abuse of the FMLA, so you can imagine in the fall or the spring, if people say that there's allergies that may develop and all of a sudden, you know, they've taken a day off on a day when it turns out to be a particularly good, let's say, you know, fall activity day warm spring
day.
Oh, yeah,
I can see it. You're asking for trouble. It's just asking for people to be not honest about it. That's the problem, right? There's too much ability to abuse the system.
Well, I think that's true. And of course, all of us still wonder why there is such abuse of the FMLA. I mean, of course, I'm coming at this from a cynical perspective where all I see is the abuse of it. So it appears as though there's a lot more than maybe there is. But, you know, you have to remember this is unpaid time. So you wonder what the point is in abusing it. But I guess that's a different topic.
Well, it can be. There's no question about that. So one of the other things you talked about is an FMLA claim where the FMLA did not apply based on reliance on language in the employer handbook.
Yeah. Now, this, I think, again, is another very significant issue. And the reason this is a little bit of a pet peeve for me, because I think employers get in a difficult position because they want to have a handbook and they want to do things the right way. But they either don't have the money or don't want to spend the money to have it written by somebody in the legal profession. And I understand that because it seems like there are 5 million handbooks on the internet and you could access any one of them. They're all published. And it seems very easy to just take somebody else's and say, oh, well, I'm going to use this one and it looks good to me. this case is an example of why not to do that. And I actually had a situation where this relatively small employer was trying to be comprehensive and do the right thing and adapted a handbook from the internet that was literally 150 pages long, where it needed to be about 6 pages long. And what happened in that situation, but also in this case, was they didn't understand which policies applied to them and which didn't. And so in this case, the employer had a handbook that had FMLA language in it, but they weren't subject to the federal FMLA. They didn't have enough people. And so an employee relied on the handbook language, and the employer used all the federal forms that are available from the website. And when the employee applied for FMLA, the employer checked off, you know, eligible, okay to go, not realizing until later that they weren't even subject to the FMLA. So at some point they tried to renege by saying, well, wait a minute, you're out, and now you're out on unauthorized time because it turns out the FMLA doesn't apply to us, which means it doesn't apply to you, so the time that you've taken has not been approved. Well, you can imagine that that did not go over well.
Very well at all.
No,
sure.
And the court decided in that case, I think, you know, reasonably so, even from an employer's perspective, that the employer relied on the very information being provided to him by the employer.
Well, 1 minute left. Talk about the FMLA vacation.
You can't take a vacation under the FMLA that doesn't have an FMLA-related purpose. So if you want to go on a cruise, that's okay. But there has to at least be a medically-related reason under the FMLA, or you have to be there in the capacity of caring for somebody, you know, under the needed-to-care-for provision. And those types of quote-unquote vacations have been approved. But otherwise, if you want to go on the Love Boat, do it on your own time.
And those are words of great advice from Anne Marie Story, employment attorney for Rudman & Winchell. Thank you very much for being on the show today, and thank you very much for being an HR Power Hour sponsor as well.
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hi, this is Doug Currier from VeralDana. Often managers do not know how to have a difficult conversation with their employees. They need to understand that it is not about winning the moment or proving the other person wrong. There's a big difference between focusing on what the company needs as opposed to what the employee is doing. To say, "We need employees to respect each other and not gossip," is much more effective than, "You are always gossiping and spreading rumors." And it is better to explain in a non-confrontational way how behavior affects others than labeling the employee a bad person. It was painful for John to hear that people were talking about him behind his back, as opposed to, "What you said about John behind his back was totally unacceptable." And you want to involve the employee in understanding the problem and crafting a solution, as opposed to talking at the employee. It's about respect and helping the employee own the solution. For further insight and advice, please reach out to Verrill & Dana's labor and employment law attorneys.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Verrill Dana's Benjamin Ford and Elizabeth Smith are going to be talking about something that's certainly technologically important and a potential risk for your organization. That is wearable technologies. What do they mean for you? And how can you make sure it's not a risk for your organization? That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.